The lights are on red. We're away.
Hello and welcome to Motopod, the internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. This is episode number 282 for Wednesday, July 13, 2011. Hi, this is Gonçalo Silva. I'm in a very early Portugal. I'm in a call with Jules Cisek that is over there in California. Jules, how are you doing?
Good. Hey, Gonçalo.
Hi.
How are you healing?
Yeah, I'm doing fine. Actually, just have two more bandages to go. I'm not counting days now. I'm counting bandages. It's how I go. I went from seven to just two on my knees now, which are the crappy parts to heal. I've been almost a week to heal them properly. But
so, for those of you who missed the episode where we it was the massive, I think 3 or 10 hour one, whatever, where Gonçalo came in to talk about World Superbikes, and it was like immediately after he crashed his bicycle
No, it wasn't. Let's stand correct. It wasn't immediately after I crashed the bicycle. I basically crashed the bicycle at 8 p.m. and then basically spent all night at the hospital until 11 a.m. and then came to do a call at 1 p.m. So right out of hospital, I could barely see the computer because one of my eyes was blocked by a huge bandage. So, it was already 4 weeks ago.
Yeah. A while ago. And you see, your cast is off your arm.
Yeah, I just need physio now. Can't move my arm properly. It's a bit stuck still. But that's why we're doing the call so early, because I need to go to the doctor's appointment at 9 a.m. To check what I need to do to get it all better.
Cool. All right, we'll make sure we get you out of here. Okay, so we obviously had good, really excellent racing and World Superbikes at Brno, so we're going to talk about that, and we're also going to talk about the Sachsenring, and we've got a bunch of listener emails that we'll go through. So let's start with one from Edwin Hazer, who's a long-time listener to the show. Good friend of the show, who actually I went to see a race at Infineon in the AFM local club series just last weekend, and he was running his crazy Kawasaki K1.
And oh yeah, I know which bike you're talking about.
Yeah.
I saw his photos on Facebook. I love that bike.
Yeah, it's amazing, and he also has a CBR 450.
Mm-hmm.
And he raced that as well. So it was just really fun watching him go around. He's super old school, very very good racer, really fun guy to hang out with. Anyways, he wrote a while back that this is what he wrote. He said, "Right now, electric bikes are still firmly in their infancy period, and total focus seems to be on the technical aspect of who will come up with the best, fastest design. How long will it take before the competition will be able to field fairly well-matched bikes to where the rider will be regarded as the most important part of the equation?" I think we're almost there, actually. I know it's early days, but if you had a couple of bikes that are as competitive as the Chish bikes, for example, right? The Moto Chish bikes?
Yeah, they did a great job at the Isle of Man.
Yeah. Yeah, and if you had two or three manufacturers that were able to have that caliber of a bike, I think you would have the rider would really start to matter at that point.
Yeah, like we saw, because the two bikes that were the Yellow Man were different, weren't they?
Yes.
Between Mark Miller and Michael Root, that's probably what made the difference. Wasn't the bike speak? Wasn't it Cheap Yates that beat the record for the electric bikes? Was it when was the Pikes race, the hill climb?
Was it Pikes Peak? Yeah,
class and saw that he beat the record by a great margin. And I saw the recording of the, because he had the onboard camera.
Right.
And it looked good. It looked obviously to move such a massive bike on the dirt.
The dirt part was painful to watch because you could tell that the weight of the bike was just making it impossible to take corners, you know.
He was just taking it very slowly to make sure that he got to the last part in the tarmac. But
yep.
It was really good. And again, it's just a matter of make the field more even, like you said, and have more bikes are similar.
Yeah.
So I guess we're on the right track.
Yeah, definitely there. We're going that way. And then you were writing in about how people can watch AMA in Europe. So
yeah.
Tell us about that.
Yeah, because I saw that most people were complaining about not being able to watch AMA. I've been paying attention to Motos TV, which I don't know how many people have. I know that he's a French. He started as a French channel, but it's mostly British now. At least what they show is mostly British, and they have AMA. I followed the entire AMA Supercross season there, and then Motocross too. And this year they're doing Superbikes too. So just a matter of paying attention to it, because they even show live races. So it's a matter of, yeah, just a matter of paying attention, because you probably can see it in Europe too. I don't know. For Portugal, you get it at the basic cable service. When you pay for cable, it comes as one of the basic channels. So look into it.
That's very cool. Yeah, we for us, it's hard to even watch MotoGP, and you guys get, you know, national series from all over the world.
I have the impression that for you it's hard to even watch AMA.
Yes.
From what I can see, there's people struggling to have AMA on the TV.
Yep.
And I noticed that.
Yeah. It's ridiculous. But we won't go down that road because it's kind of annoying. Yep. So on to another listener email. This one is from William Hall. And this was in response to us talking about it was a couple of episodes ago when we were talking about Danny Pedrosa, how many times he's been hurt, and it was something post Le Mans. Okay, so here's what William wrote. He said, I work in orthopedics, and I have a little rant that I will proceed with. Much talk of clavicle fracture these days. The vast majority of clavicle fractures do not need to be treated surgically, period, full stop. The clavicle will heal on its own, either united or as a non-union. There will be no difference in pain relief or function, whether union or non-union. Fixing clavicle fractures has certainly become more fashionable of late, especially while treating the general population. The beauty of non-surgical treatment is that there is minimal risk. And he puts in parentheses, can you say Danny Pedrosa? With surgery, there is all kinds of risk, including death. Certainly, your decision-making is different when healing with high-performance athletes. And then he says, my last point, if you're going to treat the high-performance, high-risk athletes surgically, can we stop treating them with plate and screw fixation? The problem being, tensile strength of the plate and bone is different, adding a stress riser at the bone metal surface. Basically, what he's saying is that if you put the plate there and then
it breaks on the joint of the metal between the metal and the bone.
Right. And you wouldn't
higher fracture point.
Yeah, you might break it even in a situation where you would not normally break it if you didn't have that plate in place. And this is something that actually I talked to my doctor about when I broke my collarbone some years back after a crash. And you know, he said, you know, we could operate and fix this thing right, but it's probably better if you just leave it alone. And you know, it never healed right, but it's not a total mess.
Yeah,
it looks weird. I mean, I'm sure you have those too, because you used to race, right?
No, I got that. I got that talk from the doctor back in 2004 when I broke my collarbone racing.
Yeah.
And he said the same thing. Well, we can put a plate and screw you, but there's no need, because the collarbone is not like it's not overlapped. It's basically just going to grow bone, and it's going to be it's going to be good again. Obviously, it's not going to look good because you're going to have a bump in the middle of your collarbone, but you're going to have a faster recovery and you're going to be on the track sooner. So I went with that one. And even last week, what it says here is basically like what, like listening to my doctor saying that that it's more fashionable now to have the surgery to correct the position. And because the problem now is that I have a huge bump on my dislocated shoulder. Basically, the collarbone looks out of place.
Yeah.
And he said, if you want to look good, if you don't want that bump, that's the reason why you would take the surgery. Because apart from that, you have 100% use of your collarbone, so of your shoulder. So there's really no need for it. Well, that was enough for me. I really don't need, just for aesthetics, I really don't care. So.
And besides, it's kind of nice to have a couple of scars. You've got your share, obviously.
Yeah.
You know, you could be sitting around like the guys in the movie Jaws, you know, comparing scars later on. I got this one, you know, 2004 at this track, whatever.
Yeah, for me, it's more bumps. I like this collarbone. It's one bump. 2004.
So thank you, William, for writing in, and we appreciate that. There's a lot of, obviously, a couple of shows in a row. We talked about Moto2, you know, kind of being not a true GP class, and it was then kind of solidified last week after Mugello when Andrea Dovizioso had this to say. He was asked, you rode a 250 and you've watched Moto2. Which class do you think better prepares you for MotoGP? And he said, there is no comparison. Moto2 is so bad about that for many reasons. The 252 stroke, there's nothing similar to MotoGP. But if you are fast on a 250, you are fast because it's so difficult to be fast on a 250. So when you arrive with good speed on a 250, it means you did a good job. You can understand many things and you are really precise on the throttle. This is very key, I think. Sure, you don't have to experience, you don't have the experience of riding four strokes, but if you see in the past, all the talent came from 250, and from the first year, they can fight for the podium and fight for the victory. Many people come to Superbike, and it's very similar to MotoGP, but nothing happens, blah, 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 blah. Anyway, so he was the guy that was kind of dissing Moto2.
Yeah.
And then he was asked, you know, do you think that the next generation of riders is going to be more difficult for them to adapt to MotoGP? And he said, sure, but after the talent that is in MotoGP now, everyone will come from Moto2, so it's not a problem, which is true.
Yeah, but you missed the part when he says, "I never tried the bike."
Oh, the,
so
yeah,
I can't true. Exactly say.
Yeah, I didn't want to go through the whole thing he said, but you're right. He never actually has tried a Moto2 bike.
Well, but I do understand what you're saying, and like you said, the important part is to know. The really being really precise on the throttle.
Yeah.
The fact that the Moto2 doesn't have enough power, so you're more aggressive on the throttle. Corner entry, it's a lot different because now you see the Moto2 sliding in because of the engine brake of the four-stroke engine.
Mm-hmm.
But MotoGP bikes don't have that because of all the electronics and all that. They're basically like 250s, they like two-stroke bikes. They barely have any engine brake, and that's probably going to.
Well,
they have it,
but it's you know masked by the electronics.
Well, exactly. Obviously, they have, but they don't notice it.
Right.
So probably that's the reason why he says it's so much different, and the Moto2 is not a good class to prepare you for. For MotoGP, but I guess the only example we have so far is Tony Elias and Abraham are the only two that use Moto2 and they're now in MotoGP.
Right, one's Abraham's doing really
not
well.
Doing, yeah, Abraham's not doing a bad job at all, and well, Elias is, well, a different case.
Yeah, but Elias is a crusty, you know, veteran of many classes, and he's got a riding style, and he just won't change it.
Well, yeah, and we know he had problems even before he went to Moto2, so it's not actually. Right. I guess we'll have to wait and see to have more of Moto2 riders coming up to to MotoGP, and then we'll see if the Vizioso is great. I guess he has a point. It's a fair point. But at the same time, is it really that important? I don't know.
Right. And we had a bunch of listeners who wrote in about that. So Chris Gilbert wrote in and said, I think that it was Davi that said Moto2 was a proper push for MotoGP. But I wonder how long that will be the case. Last year, the bikes were a bit loose and the racing was super close, which might suggest that they were relatively easy to set up and ride, as many people were close. This year, I've heard that the Suter is tricky to set up and get the best out of, but it's clearly works well when it is set up properly, and Marquez, when he doesn't fall off, it occasionally flashes from Scott Redding. That suggests that setup is becoming more important and the bike is sensitive to change. I wonder if the manufacturers are just taking time to get the bikes to the fine edge of 250s that was developed over the years. You can expect them to be at that level in year one with no history. You can't expect them to be at that level in year one with no history and feedback to work from. Given a couple of more years to refine the formula and engine rules opening up, I wouldn't be surprised to see Moto2 to come a lot closer to the mini MotoGP. And let's just hope that the racing stays as good as early years of the class, which is true. And of course, the motor itself is going to be evolving. I believe that next year it's going to be a little more powerful, right? They're
going to
try squeezing more power.
It's not going to be just on the engine. It's not going to be a single supplier for the engine. So
right, I think 2013.
So we'll see some changes there. Well, what Chris is talking about, the fact that Suter is tricky to set up, we actually discussed that with Askel in Esrul.
Yep.
And he admitted himself that the bike was more of, more like a cutting edge where it's like a pyramid, like a really thin area where you could work in. And compared to the first year of Moto2, where every bike was basically rubbish, according to what he said, was the bikes weren't as good as they are this year. They're getting harder to set up. That's true. And Suda is having a lot of issues with most of the riders. Scott Redding is a very good example.
Yeah.
And it was lapped at a Mugello. A rider that last year was fighting for podiums, was lapped in Mugello without apparent reason. So things are not going well, and I don't know if you should consider the fact that they're harder to set up as a good thing or as a bad thing. It's if you're gonna have so many bikes on the paddock, on the grid, you need to have a bike that it's easier to set up because you're going to have a lot of different styles riding it. And they say that the Suda now is too set up for only one type of riding. Well, that it seems the
is that
to
the
be
problem?
The
I thought it was more of a... there was so many things that you can change about it.
Yeah, that's what he said. I'm saying what people are talking about. Apparently, the bike is too... Well, it's easier to set up for someone that rides like a small Spanish racer.
Named Marquez?
Yeah. And some British folks and some Turkish ones are complaining that the bike is it's too hard to... it doesn't adapt properly. And you have Iannone, which is a different rider from Marquez too, and he's complaining too. I don't know. It might be the fact that they're not getting to that point where the bike is working for them. And in that case, is their problem, or it might be the Suda engine, the Suda frame, that it's not working well with the tires now for most of the riders. I don't know. Do we have any more responses to
We had a bunch of, but I don't want to beat a dead horse. All in the same kind of vein. We also talked last week about the BSB races at Snetterton, and Martin said, he wasn't sure why it was called the Snetterton 300 now, and we got an email from John Blow, who says that the new Snetterton layout has a couple of junctions in it, making it a rough figure of eight and giving three configurations: the 100, 200, and 300, which are roughly 1 mile, 2 mile, and 3 miles respectively. So they were running on the third configuration, obviously, and that's why it was called the Schneider 10300.
Yeah. Yeah, when I saw it, I'm like, are they going to do endurance racing now? What's up with 300? Because every time we mention a 500, 300 race, it's usually kilometers. It's going to be an endurance race.
Right.
Like, doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
Because actually, most people were talking about the Snerton. The layout wasn't appealing. I actually enjoy the new area of the track. I liked it.
So I've never seen racing it there before, so I don't know I didn't have anything to compare it to, but I thought the racing was great and it looked cool.
Yeah. Shall we move on to what I guess is one of the important points of
all
the feedback?
Go ahead.
Well, we got an email from Sienna Burke and said, well, hello, could you explain the claiming rule? I've heard you make reference to it, but I'm unclear how it works and why it's going to be initiated for the new era of GP racing.
Yeah, it's a big topic. We're not going to cover all of it, but it's a big topic. So I think it's worth going through. Like you made some nice notes here about the official rulings and stuff. So let's just go through that.
But yeah, the MotoGP class for 2012. Was agreed that it will have a capacity up to 1,000 cc, maximum number of cylinders of 4 cylinders. They can put it whatever configuration they want, but just 4 cylinders. But it'll have a maximum bore of 81 millimeters, and this is important. And then the minimum weight is going to be 150 kilograms for bikes up to 800. CC, for example, if someone runs an 800 like this year, for next year, they're going to be 150 kilograms as it is now. Mm-hmm. And then 153 for whatever bike that it's over 800 CC up to 1000. The maximum number of engines going to still be 6 engines and 21 liters for the fuel tank. But this is where it gets interesting, because for the CRTs, considered the claiming rule teams, you're going to have 12 engines and 24 liters. So what is the claiming rule team? The idea is that any CRT competing in the series will be able to claim. Well, I shouldn't get into
this. Well, so actually, the official explanation of what a CRT team is that it's a team that's not represented. It cannot represent an MSMA manufacturer, which is right now considered Honda, Yamaha, Ducati, Suzuki. So a CRT cannot represent one of those manufacturers. And they can use, quote, production parts, specifically the motor, can be come off of a production bike. For example, the BMW S1000RR, the Aprilia RSV4 are two targeted engines that we're surely going to see some bikes running those. They have to have prototype chassis, but the claiming rule itself means that the engine that after any race, another team can come and buy that engine and take the engine from you for 20,000 euros with the transmission and for 50,000 euros without the transmission. And that's basically the explanation of it. But why, right? Why do you do that? The reason why you do this is because when you have a competitor that does really well because they sunk a huge amount of money into developing this motor that was originally a production motor, they already have all these other bonuses. They get twice as many engines per season per rider. They have more fuel to use. And imagine now them sinking huge amounts of money and building a very expensive motor that is competitive with the MSMA, the MotoGP bikes, that then somebody can go and buy it for 20,000 euros. So it basically is preventing teams from making that motor you know, putting too much money into making that motor, you know.
It's basically cost reduction.
It's cost reduction by saying it's just not worth it because somebody could buy that motor from you. The interesting thing is that other CRT teams are not the ones that can buy the motor. It's only the MSMA teams, which means they're going to take that motor and they're just going to put it, you know, in the box. Or maybe they're going to take it apart.
I was missing their part of the rule then. So
that's what I only just learned as I was preparing for this show. Here's what MotoGP Director of Technology, Corrado Ceccinelli, said specifically. He says that the team, in order to be a CRT team, they have to accept that one of their engines can be claimed, which means it can be bought at the end of the race by one of the MSMA members. Specifically, he said that specifically for those 20,000 euros or 15,000 euros without the transmission. And there's also all sorts of extra rules there where, like, each MSMA team can only buy one engine from each CRT team, and each CRT team can only have its engines bought four times during the season. So there's all sorts of goofy rules that neither side can take advantage of it. But the main idea of this cost cutting is basically don't sink, you know, $500,000 euros into the engine because somebody can then buy it for 20.
Yeah, well, I guess those rules that you just described are just the way to try and please the MSMA.
Yes,
because
they
were so complaining so much about the claiming rule team. Yeah. The fact is, how is racing gonna be once we have the CRTs?
Well, we talked about that. What it actually is, what it means, is a completely different game, right?
Yeah, yeah, that's. And the fact that it's how competitive it's going to be, how those rules and the fact that they can have double as many engines and the 3 more liters of fuel, how much that's going to play to actually be competitive against factory teams. The first showing we got was the Mark VDS by with Kallio at Mugello, and it was 6.7 seconds slower than. Then Stoner, I think it was 6.7 seconds.
That's per lap. First,
yeah,
just to make sure people understand, it's per lap.
So that would mean to be lapped fairly quickly, but the Mark VDS bike, and as David Hammett described, might not be the best bike to judge the CRTs, as it has a BMW engine, which, as we know, have been having a lot of problems with electronics from World Superbike because they keep insisting on doing their own electronics instead of going with a Minarelli system like everyone else does. So it might not be the best bike, and the frame is very similar to what they have in Moto2 now, and as we saw, it's been having a couple of issues too, and Mika Kallio might not be the most competitive guy on that bike, so It's not everything's lost, so we'll see. They might come into a good play, this thing between more fuel or less fuel. And one of the interesting things that I found about the CRTs is that you can get into the championship as a CRT. You get approved to be a CRT because at the beginning of the season, you basically present your team to the board, and they say, well, okay, you're a CRT, you can use 12 engines, and you can use 24 liters. But if for some reason it's shown that you're basically a cover-up for a factory team, like for Aprilia, for example, if they start seeing too many members from the Aprilia factory walking around your garage and all that,
God.
They can consider you a factory team by unanimous. What is it? They need to have 3 votes against four. They're four. It's the Dorna, FIM,
right, and ERTA,
MSMA, and ERTA.
Yeah,
those are the four members that decide if you're a CRT or not. So it's going to be difficult to change, but that can happen. If they notice that your team is not actually a CRT and it's basically a cover-up for factory effort, and you're going to be in the middle of the season going back to 21 liters and 6 engines. So it's interesting rules. It's going to be interesting to see how the teams will react, especially these new ones, and see how they'll behave. So I don't know. We'll see. So, I guess what most people are expecting from 2012 is to go back to 2006. I should let you know right now that's not going to happen. There's too many electronics involved right now. It's been too many years, and we're still going to have bikes that are basically on rails. I was reading what Stern said, which was a very interesting piece by Stern. So if you haven't read it yet, you should read it about riding the 1000 compared to riding the 800cc. He was basically talking about his riding style and all that. He says it's not going to be much different. He came from one to the other, and he said it doesn't feel the difference unless you're talking about higher gear, like 4th, 5th, 6th, where you notice you have more grunt from the engine. So you're basically going to be able to run higher gearing, and you're going to feel like the wheel is spinning at those speeds, something that doesn't happen with a 800. So we'll probably see guys like Stoner, as we saw in Philip Island, just basically sliding the bike one side to the other, which is his riding style. He's basically going to do it better with the 800 than he does with the 1000, sorry, than it does with the 800. But don't expect much from him, as it's going to be quite slow.
Beyond that, you mean?
Well, not slow. It's not going to be as exciting as it was.
As it used to be, yeah. Yeah, and the other thing is that there probably will be a huge gap between the factory teams and most of the CRT teams. And, you know, they are there to, allow more entries, which is good both for Dorna because they want to fill the grid up. Most racers feel that any time the grid has less than 20 riders, it's kind of pathetic, and that's been the case for three years now. So that's going to be good, but you know, there may be one or two teams, that CRT teams, that are somewhat competitive and can fight with some of the satellite MotoGP teams maybe, but I wouldn't expect, you know, them to be winning races.
If we have CRTs in the top 10, I think that would be a great achievement for them.
Yeah, exactly. You know, there's probably going to be they're not going to definitely do this officially, but there's going to be an unofficial kind of, you know, best CRT team, and people are going to be following that, just like, you know.
Yeah, the second championship inside the championship.
Yeah.
Well, perhaps. I think that's gonna happen, obviously.
Dorna's not going to promote that as an actual, you know, prize or anything like that. That's going to be very bad for them.
But between the teams, I'm sure they're going to have bragging rights.
Especially
because
totally.
Most the teams are basically Moto2 teams that are going up for the SCRTs. So they already have the disputes in Moto2, and now they have it. They're going to have it in the MotoGP. So it's going to be interesting.
And Colin can do shots whenever a CRT team passes a MotoGP bike or something.
Oh, that would be depressing. That if you say to Colin, you can only drink when you get passed by a CRT team, poor guy would drink nothing.
No, not them. Not them. I'm saying any MotoGP bike.
Oh, okay. Okay. In that case, I'll be like, yeah, come on, Ducatis, come on, satellite Ducatis, get all behind. Right. Okay, so we had last weekend one of my favorite venues for either MotoGP or World Superbike. We went to Brno in the Czech Republic.
That's actually where you and I met.
Yeah, actually right. Is.
Yeah,
such good memories.
Yes. Of the ice bike.
Actually, we should have chatted for a little bit longer, but you know, it is, you're working, I wasn't, So, yeah, but I really like that that place. I was hoping that I was able to make it this year, but nah, not gonna happen.
Oh well.
So anyway, World Superbike was a good one, as World Superbike rounds tend to be compared to MotoGP nowadays. And we had a very interesting Super Bowl and very good races for the three main classes, for the two main classes, three main races, for Superbike and Supersport. And before I start, I had to put this up. And I don't know, for those who watch Eurosport in English and get James Whitten as a commentator, does anyone notice that he sounds like one of those Martians from Sesame Street?
It's so funny because when you wrote that, I was like, I never thought that before, but now I'm always going to have that in my head. It's going to be stuck in my head.
Yeah, when Barnacle is like, what do you think? Yep. Oh, man. I was watching, was it one race or was the Super Bowl? I was like, why does it sound like something that is familiar to me? And then I started thinking, I basically cracked up and started laughing all by myself watching the race, because every time he did it, it just reminds me of one of those Martians from Sesame Street. He basically it just looks like he found a phone and he was too happy. Yep.
Now he's going to spread that meme to everybody. No one's going to be able to watch a Superbike race on Eurosport without laughing.
It's going to have a new nickname. It's going to be James the Martian Whitten.
Excellent.
Okay, you want to do Super Bowl?
Go for it.
Okay. So Super Bowl was interesting. It was very windy on Saturday, and it might have caught a few riders out. And Laverty started well with, as he was the fastest man at free practice just before the Super Bowl. And those that didn't go through Super Bowl were Ruben Zales, again having a bad weekend. Rolfo with a Pergini, Kawasaki, Lescors, Vermeulen, Alex Lowes that was standing in for Johnny Rea.
Yep.
And didn't do a bad job, but we'll go to that afterwards. And
Kis Pataki.
Was a free wild card rider, isn't he?
Yeah, Hungarian. He went over across the border.
Yeah. Ah, oh, damn him. It's really close. Everything's close around there.
Yeah.
So, we had the wind that was blowing down the straight. Everyone was complaining a little bit, saying that it was affecting some of the corners, and because Brno is such a high speed track, if it's windy, it might cause your bike to be a little bit out of balance and cause some crashes. Biaggi was almost binned it in SP1 straight out of the pits on lap 3 before he was able to have a good lap in. But it was his teammate Kamya that didn't have a good weekend at all, and it started with Super Bowl crashing on FP1, but still made it in time for SP2.
Yeah.
As James Whitten was saying, the fact that Bruno has that road that goes through the middle, it's very easy to go from one side to the pit. It's actually kind of close. It's not like almost all the circuits that have only one road going around it. This one actually has one going straight through it. So.
I know it well.
Yeah. I'd imagine you had to walk it many times, didn't you?
Oh, yeah. Totally. It was a lifesaver, yeah, right. Actually.
Yeah, so so the grid was Max Biaggi, followed by Melandri, Checa.
Well, hang on. You got to give Biaggi some credit here. He wasn't in the number one spot, and all of a sudden he pulled an amazing lap. And I was actually wondering whether maybe he got lucky and the wind died down or something during his that one lap. Because, I mean, he was, what, three-tenths faster than Melandri in second. Which is pretty significant, because the rest of them were very, very close. It was a very close Super Bowl. The first four guys, anyway.
Checo was the first one to get into the 50s. The track was obviously different conditions from previous year, where Crutchlow did a 158 there, while Max Biaggi only managed a 158.5.
Right.
But track conditions were very different. And yeah, the lap that Biaggi got for pole was really fast one compared to everyone else this weekend. And another thing that I found amazing was the fact that Aitchison, the Australian riding for Pedrettini, actually made it to Super Pole. And not only Super Pole 1, but he made it to Super Pole 2.
Yeah.
And he got and he basically took Aslam into the last places on SP1, making Aslam one of the riders that didn't go through, which was a very good effort from Aitchison, that then ended up in 11th place to start, which is not a good, is not a bad result for the Pedrettini Kawasaki.
No, it was great. They were actually pretty. They had a great weekend in general.
You got Max Biaggi with a 158.5, and then Melandri 3/10 behind him, then Checa, and then was kind of close from Mirrorland. Then you got Eugene Laverty, Jakob Smart. That only feels the pressure of riding at home. It never goes as well as he goes at other venues. And then you have Fabrizio on a good weekend.
Who loves Leon this track. Camia.
Yeah. That showed, didn't you? Didn't it?
Oh, yeah.
It showed on race 1 and 2.
Yeah.
And then Leon Camia, Tom Sykes, Ayrton Badovini, again, best BMW. Well, obviously, with BMW being short two bikes, got to mention that, with Troy Corser and James Toseland out for this round. James Toseland actually tried to ride Friday in pre-practice 1, but ended up deciding not to because his wrist is still giving him a lot of trouble. So then he had in 11th Mark Aitchison and then Maxime Berger. He's French. I would say Berger, but he's French. So. Then Leon Aslam, Noriyuki Aga, Lorenzo Lanzi standing in for Toseland, and Matteo Baiocco. Is it right, Baiocco? And he is fighting for the Italian Superbike Championship, isn't he? And he's actually a good record for him to be able to move into Super Bowl. So I guess the negative notes go to Aslam and Aga, only managed to 13th and 14th.
Right.
And especially Aslam, that is showed to be not happy at all with BMW. So now you do race 1.
Race 1 was, well, both races were excellent, and both races were interesting because they both featured the riders who are kind of, you know, they're the top three guys in the
championship riders.
Yeah. So the most notable thing in the beginning of the race was a really nasty crash that Chaus had on lap 1.
Well, live it was hard to see because we were so far back that we couldn't actually see it, but then they show the replay, and it was he basically high sided, but still hold on to the bike. So when he crashed,
oh, that's right.
When he fell in front of the bike basically clipped him and hit him again, and it was a nasty one. And it was in the middle of the track, and I was expecting the race to be red flagged because I thought, well, he's going to be injured. He's going to be in the middle of the track, and they're going to have to get a red flag.
Right.
Well, because the lap is so long, they were able to get the bike and get Zales out of the way. At the time, I thought, well, he hurt himself, and he went to Clinica
Mobile. Oh,
well, yeah, it's not the same as MotoGP, but apparently just got bruised, but he skipped race 2, was badly bruised, but
yeah.
Nothing broken, which means he can come back and destroy more bikes for the next round.
God. He's not having a good 4 years.
Yeah, he's not been having a good career for a while now.
Yeah, unfortunately.
I think since he was a runner-up back when, 2004?
Well, I would say, I guess. And I mean, he had a couple of decent years in MotoGP, actually.
In MotoGP, you'd say?
Yeah, he. I think he finished in the podium at Qatar in 2004 or 2005, and then didn't crash a couple of times. So
yeah, but still, yeah, he destroyed a lot of fairings.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah,
he destroyed a lot. But I guess
Biagio Malanger and Checa checked out. They were the front group. In both races, Fabrizio sort of hung in with them, but he never really had any chance of catching up with them anymore. And, you know, in the final standings, he was 8 seconds behind. But those three guys stuck together, and Checa was, I think, really hoping for Biagi and Melange to heat it up and make a mistake together, and he would be right there to pounce on it. But Biagi did his typical... Every once in a while, running a little wide, allowing Melange through, having to fight back.
Even allowing Checa through at some point.
Yes, that's right. He did. But he got right back on it.
Yeah.
Was James Whittam,
back.
Or as James Whittam would say, Biagi makes the mistake, and then the Aprilia allows him to get past Checa again.
Yeah.
The guy, I don't think Whittam likes Biagi at all.
Who does? Honestly,
I like Piaggi. I think he's okay.
Well,
on the track.
Who else? Apart
on the track.
From you?
On the track.
Yeah. No, I like him too on the track. I think we should mention Alex Lowes because he actually did a great job, especially because unlike his teammate, he kept it on two wheels, and he was running as high as 13th at some point and ended up finishing 15th and scoring points or a point.
Right.
Which is very good. He had a crazy season so far. He came from the Evo bikes and BSV to a full, I wouldn't say factory, bike and BSV, but a very good team at BSV, and now doing a wild card standing in a factory team in World Superbike. I would say the pressure is big and he stepped up to it, I guess.
Yeah,
it was a good result for him. And who else? The BMWs, the BMW fight. I think it's an interesting one because we have a factory team and then we have a satellite factory team, as we can call it that. And Badovini is taking the edge over Aslam for a couple of rounds now. Aragon was the same thing, and now Bruno Badovini finishes in front of Aslam. Actually, way ahead of Aslam in this race, because Badovini got into the fight with Sykes and Smerts and then Lascaux for sixth place, passed them, went through and started gapping them, while Aslam was sitting in 10th in the second to last lap, and then managed to finish 8th, which doesn't really represent his pace for the entire race, where he ran between 11th, 10th, and never better than that.
Well, it only matters at the end, when you cross the line.
Yeah, it does, but I'm pretty sure it doesn't matter. It matters to him.
It matters to him, and he's not been a happy camper. I mean, you just look at him on the grid before the races, and he's just not happy. He's not happy with the bike. He's not happy with the development of the bike. And this is the second year in a row where he's on a machine that he outrides, I guess.
Yeah,
you know?
Certainly.
Something's certainly going on. But then again, you know, Aaron Badovini is on a satellite team, and look at him go.
Badovini is the second year with the BMW, even though they're different BMWs, because he was in Superstock last season, and now he is in Superbike.
That's
they're two
point.
Different bikes, but it's... But it's still a BMW. It's still the same frame. It's still the same bike, more or less.
That's a good
so
point.
So he has that edge over Aslam. But still, Aslam, he's a great, great, talented rider. And I think has been screwed by the BMW electronics, which is basically the complaint that everyone has that rides a BMW. And we can see it. We see it, obviously.
I will say that I'm actually glad that BMW is trying to get into the electronic part of it, because we need some competition. Like, Magneti Marelli has had a virtual monopoly on electronics in World Superbikes and in MotoGP for freaking ever, you know. And
yeah.
I can understand that the riders and probably the teams are getting frustrated, but I am glad to see that somebody's trying to do their own thing, maybe something a little bit different, you know. I mean, the main problem with the BMWs is the tire longevity issue, which you know, it takes years to gather the data and years to perfect that the characteristics of the, you know, the way you output the power to keep the tires alive. And, you know,
and yeah, Magneti Marelli running basically the monopoly, and when it comes to electronics, they obviously, they're not going to show how to do it.
No, exactly.
So BMW are going in the dark and trying to get their own electronics going, but it's taking 3 years now, the third year.
Yeah.
Everyone was expecting the BMW to be winning by now.
Yeah.
And still hasn't happened. And we'll see if things keep going this way. It won't happen for a while. But the question is, will they keep developing their own electronics, or at some point they're going to throw in the towel and go with the Italians?
Right.
I don't know. I don't know if that's going to happen, because they're BMW. BMW doesn't start.
I don't see it. I don't see the. They also have sunk so much in there. They're probably falling prey to the not invented here syndrome, all that kind of stuff. So I don't see them switching to, certainly not to Magneti Marelli. In that way, that's almost like the competition for them.
Well, yeah, exactly.
You know.
Yeah, it was actually the last six laps. There was a couple of passes. I really enjoyed one of the laps where they passed each other four times. The passing between Biaggi and Melendri. Biaggi would try to pass him, and then Melendri got him straight after. It was actually pretty interesting. And then with three laps to go, Biaggi was ahead. Melendri got a last move, and Biaggi obviously couldn't respond by running wide in a couple of corners. So we lost the edge there, and Melendri won, which is a pretty good result for him. He's back on his 2005 groove, I think.
That's right.
And it's good to see him doing so, because very talented rider, and it's good to have him back.
Let's go on. So he wins the race. Biaggi and Checa are within half a second of him. But the interesting thing about Brno and these three bikes, even though Checa's probably hurting a bit on the top speed, even when they're close, it's actually very difficult for them to make a pass and make it stick.
Yeah.
You know, this is because it's a very flowing track. You have to have a lot of corner speed. These three guys are all really good with corner speed.
Yeah, Checa looked very composed from the beginning of the race. Always, well, it's his season motto is calm and composed. So it was looking good. But as you say, it's a very flowy track, and to be able to pass, you need to stick it with a very aggressive move on the brakes, and usually means you're going to run wide. That's why there's so much passing and repassing straight away, because it's usually you're not able to keep the line.
Right. It's a very it's all about momentum here. So yeah, congrats to Marco, and it's good to see him on the podium. He was very happy, obviously. We went to race two, and you didn't think it was as good as race one. I thought it was. I think now that I'm remembering it, it's race two was resolved much later. So there was a moment where you're kind of sitting on the edge of the seat and you really didn't know how it was going to end, even as we were getting to, I mean, there was still racing on the last lap, you know? So that's probably why I remember it fondly.
Yeah, that's true. for race two, obviously, we didn't count with Zales because he was too hurt to do race two.
Yep.
So we only had, again, only one Tenkate at the grid.
Now, Vermeulen, did...
No, he didn't start the first race, did he?
No, he did. He did. He finished 18th, he did. Actually.
Oh, I guess didn't see him at all.
Yeah.
I thought he didn't even start it. I thought he was still having trouble.
But I think he was really just exhausted. He didn't start. I mean, he's still recovering from all those injuries. So, because he didn't start race two, but he didn't crash in race one. So that's why I was like, it's strange not to see him there.
Still hoping for Vermeulen to turn into Melandri now, to have these bad seasons going through and then coming back to his old self. But injuries are very hard to overcome, especially the ones he had.
Yeah, definitely.
There's not as much to talk about on race two. The fighting for the lead was down two, basically. The Checo was close for most of the race, but then after, I don't know, I would say midway, he started dropping back a little bit and finished with 3.5 seconds from Biaggi, who won the race against Melandri.
Yep.
But the race itself between Biaggi and Melandri was really close and was very interesting. We had a couple of crashes. Camier had a bad start and then ended up crashing. And then we had Smars with the same type of crash, which apart from Zales, I think everyone crashed the same way. Everyone lost the front.
Right.
Going through corners.
And Badovinia, like you said, kind of edged out Haslam. So yeah, Biaggi, Milan, Checa on the podium. Fabrizio once again fourth. It was a solid fourth. He did have to fight Laverty and Badovini and Haslam and Lescors, actually. There was quite a big train there for a while, but Fabrizio was able to power away from that. Eugene Laverty had a kind of a quiet weekend, finished fifth both races. And then we had Badovini in sixth again, Haslam, Lescors, Grintoli, Haga, Rolfo, Aitchison. So 11th and 12th for Pedercini, very good results there. Lanzi, Sykes, and the wild card, Kispataki, finished in the points. He got a point.
Yeah.
Very cool. Well, I mean, there was a lot of...
There was only
15 finishers, but, you know he did finish.
Well, he kept her upright, so that's a plus. That's always good. I was just noticing the top six for both races, apart from mixing Melandri with Biaggi, which changes from race one to race two, top six were the same top six both races.
Yeah, yep. Carlos Checa, Max Biaggi's in second. So Carlos has it was a gift from Melandri to win race one because that helped keep the points bleed down to just 13 points from Max. So he's 30 points ahead of Max Biaggi. There's five rounds left, so there's still... Yeah, there's still 250 points on the table.
I think, well, if Biaggi had won the first race, it would be 25 points
Exactly. So having
it would be one race win.
Yep. And Melandri still within shot. I mean, there's actually a lot of riders that are you know, mathematically could still win the championship, all the way down to Chaos even. But realistically, it's really just down to Checa, Biaggi, Melandri.
The first races were very strong for Checa.
Yeah.
But I think that coming out of Bruno with still 30 points, it's very good because, as we know, Bruno wasn't the ideal racetrack for Ducati. So for him to still come out on the lead with 30 points ahead of Biaggi by scoring two podiums, I think he was actually very pleased with that.
Oh, yeah.
He was pleased to sit there and take third, both races, not push too much. And
he even said in an interview after the second race, he said, you know, this is kind of what the plan was, and it worked out great. You know, he didn't expect to be higher than in the third. And, we're going to Silverstone, which is going to be another track where he'll suffer a little bit, I think.
Yeah, on the last weekend of July.
Yeah.
I don't know, Silverstone has... Yeah, but it has slow corners. It has
one slow corner.
Yeah, well, it's still more than what Bruno has.
Well, Bordeaux has that one corner that's taking the second gear. Yeah, the quote hairpin. It's the lowest point of the track, and then you start climbing.
That stadium area.
Yep,
the
exactly.
big stadium area, the right and then left. That area is mostly second gear.
Yep.
So we'll see. We'll see how Silverstone's gonna treat him. I think Biaggi is gonna run wide in a couple of places in Silverstone.
Right.
So let's see. But that's like betting. That's betting on the obvious.
Right.
I would win that bet.
Congratulations, Gonzalo.
Yeah. But anyway, now let's move on to World Supersport. Qualifying. It's a shame that qualifying doesn't show on TV, but because we only have the times to ourselves with. So Foray got the pole position, followed by Park, Salom, Rea. This is the front row. And then Maxime Roccoli, Sam Lowes, Chaz Davis. Well, I wouldn't say a good start for Davis. Not a good qualifying for the championship leader. And then Robin Harms, Tamburini, Miguel Pry in 10th. Quite a good qualifying from the Portuguese, so good for him. Then Marino Scaza.
Scaza's going backwards.
Yeah, Scaza's not going well, especially after that penalty that he had.
Yep.
And had to sit out one round. Then James Allison, and then... What's his name?
Jezek is a Czech rider.
Jezek, okay. And then Januzo and so on, so on. I think the most important point is pointing out that Skaza was starting 12th, which is, as you say, is going backwards. He started a great season and then started going down from there. Let's move on to the race.
Yeah, we finally saw something that we've been really expecting for all season. We've been wanting to see this with this win, I think.
Yeah, Gina Rea taking it with class and a lot of style.
I mean, that guy is so fun to watch. Even when he's alone on the track, he's fun to watch.
Yeah, he's one of those guys. If he was this, sometimes this happens. I don't know if that happens to you. There's a couple of racetracks where I can see a MotoGP race without a single pass, and I still find it beautiful. And still enjoy it to the max. I'm trying to remember what was the race this season, where that happened. But can't remember right now and move on. But sometimes it happens, you know what I mean? The riding is so good by itself, even without any passing.
Right.
They just enjoy seeing them go around. And Johnny Rea is one of those cases. He's just so aggressive. And he has such a peculiar style with his elbows out and head almost touching the ground is crazy, and I love to see it, and makes me more exciting watching the race just because he's racing like that so close to the other riders.
Yeah,
but yeah, the race basically was between him and Foray. Ray had a great start from fourth in the grid, and then Foray passed him, and there were a couple of laps like that, and where Ray followed Foray. And then put in such an aggressive move on Foray to pass for the lead. But then again, it's Gino Reyes, so it probably wasn't that aggressive for him. Just looked aggressive for us. And went on to hold a little bit of an edge over Foray. And as he said after the race, he actually had more if he needed to fight with anyone. So it's actually very good. The race ended up being red flagged with two laps to go because of, apparently, we didn't see this, but I went to check the results and check Miguel Pryor's comments after the race, and apparently he was the one that caused the red flag.
Oh,
I watched the
really?
Race. I didn't, yeah, because I watched the race and they didn't explain what happened because they went out of, they stopped the broadcast straight after the race. After the comments, so they didn't know what happened, but it was prior that with two laps to go, he was in ninth, doing one of the best races he ever had in World Supersport, and going ninth, he could see the fight for sixth, so he said that he pushed a little bit harder to get into that fight and to fight for better position, ended up losing the front and destroyed the bike, so probably that was the cause for the ref, like, because he never saw it. So,
so championship standings.
Championship standings. It's still Chaz Davis going ahead with 121 points, 36 ahead of Brock Parts, who crashed out of the race about four laps in. Lost the front on the chicane, fighting with his teammates alone. And basically, there was a gift for Chaz, who finished third.
Right.
So now we have Chaz Davis with 121, Brock Parts following with 36 points behind, the same as Foray. They're not tied for second place.
And that's a very sizable lead, because we only race once per round, and there's with
yeah.
five rounds remaining, you know, that's very big.
That might be the Davies, might be Chaz's year with his visa,
yeah.
with his result. And then we have, it's very tight for second place, because we have down from second with Brock Parts to sixth with Sam Lowers. There's only 12 points between them.
Right.
And there might be the next few races with Sam Lowers is going to run at home, obviously, so we expect a good result from him. Chaz Davis is the same thing, but he's already in the lead, so it's going to be interesting. Even if the fight for the lead of the championship is kind of settled, and Chaz only has to keep his lead and watch his rivals, it's going to be an interesting championship to the end of it. Gino Ri obviously was bumped up to 8th place with this win, which was really good win, and congratulations to him for a great result, and hope to see more from him.
Yeah, and then the next round is the Silverstone, as we mentioned, but the next race that we're going to be, that we're interested in is the MotoGP race at the Sachsenring.
Sachsenring.
And that's this weekend, so that should be fun. This is one of my favorite tracks, and you say it's one of yours as well, right?
Yeah, well, it's a beautiful track. It's always given us great racing, so.
Exactly, exactly. I kind of wrote down a couple of notes about this, because going way back to like 2003 and 2004, we had some amazing battles here with Rossi and Gibernau.
2003 was the one that Gibernau stole the lead on the last
corner.
Yeah, on the straight, basically.
Yeah,
he cut the last corner.
It's like that. What is it called? The Queckenberg curve, the drive he got out of it took Rossi by surprise.
Yeah, and it was that was a really good win.
Very close. I think he won by like 0.006 seconds. And then we had 2006, which had that epic Rossi 11th to first. You know, now the track is, this is one of the weirdest tracks on the MotoGP calendar, because it's slow, and then it has a very fast section, and slow, and fast section, and it's very left-handed. There's only a couple of rights, and one of those rights is at the end of a very long straight, you know, which is also going uphill. So you tend to have a cool tire in the one place where you need the most grip, and we actually saw that dramatically in 2008 when Pedrosa crashed there. But there's really, you know, one classic place where you pass, which is turn 13, is the Sachsen curve. During that race in 2006, we saw it was like the classic textbook Sachsen ring passing there. Rossi just, you know, lap
one
after lap,
the other.
You know,
yeah.
Just taking people there two at a time sometimes. And last year we saw a great race there with it was in 2009 we saw a great race with Rossi and Lorenzo there, where Lorenzo
yeah.
almost managed to do that to Rossi,
yeah,
you know,
almost
at that corner, you know, right towards the end of the race. Very reminiscent of the Rossi Gibernau battles.
You mentioned here the hilarious incident between Kenny Jr. and Tamada. I don't remember that.
Oh, this is great. They were, I believe, going between T8 and T9, and Kenny Jr. ran into Tabata and took both of them out, and then they were laying in the gravel, and they had some words. It looked like, and you know, I think the commentary was something like, you know, oh, this is not good. They're upset. You know, one of them's upset to the other, and turned out after the race that Kenny Jr. was trying to say that he was really sorry to Tamada, but he was saying it in Japanese, and his Japanese was so bad that Tamada just started laughing. So they, you know, it was completely not what we saw. And then of course 2008 was. So you know, one of the things that was mentioned at the last round by a lot of the commentators was you know, we're going to go to Germany where it always rains. Well, it's only really rained on race day. Now, granted, the weather has been is very, very volatile there, but we've only actually had one race that was affected by rain in the last 10 years, and that was the one in 2008 where Pedrosa crashed, which had that, you know, crazy crash with
nasty,
the flying bike.
Crash.
Yeah, and Stoner ended up winning that one.
But yeah, it seems the forecast for this weekend is rain. According to the forecast, is going to be very close to rain. If it doesn't rain, it's going to be close to it.
Yeah. Yep.
Before move on, you were talking about how the track is and all that. I read Dennis Noy is making a comment on Twitter saying that Sachsenring is for MotoGP, as for Pretoria TT is for AMA. Flat track racing, which you basically left turn, right, which is basically very similar kind of track, short, fast, a lot of left turns and only a few rights. Obviously, TT only has one right and a jump, but I guess I understood what he meant.
Yeah. No, I get it. Let's see the big other. Kind of stat, interesting stat is this is going to be Rossi's 250th start. Caparossi still is. I mean, he's going to lead this for, you know, an eternity. He's going to be his 322nd.
322 if he starts. Apparently, came out and saying that no one else rides his bike, and apart from him, saying that he's not very happy about. Gintoli maybe riding his bike, so he's trying to get back to ride it.
Right.
So we'll see.
Yep. It'll be good to see Lars out there. I mean, you know, he's not gonna. I want to see him finish out the season. It would suck if he had to leave in the middle of the season and then retire. You know.
Yeah, might as well finish it. I hope he does.
Yeah.
Well, we don't know if he's gonna retire or not.
We don't. But you know.
If it came down to Caparossi or Edwards having to retire, I think the choice is pretty obvious.
Right. In the last notes from last year, you know, this was just a reminder. This was the first year where we had the six-engine rule, and Lorenzo lost one engine there in quite an explosive way. It was doing qualifying or free practice?
I think it was free practice.
Yeah, free practice, I think, yeah.
Sure.
Right. Yeah, anyway, his bike went on fire and he had to eject.
Well, if you're going to talk about bikes on fire with in Sachsenring, I think there's only one big barbecue. It was Edwards in 2003 with the Aprilia.
Yeah, the cube.
That was the big barbecue.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, where he didn't even really know he was on fire. He was just like, something smells funny.
What's for lunch?
Okay, so that's going to be this weekend. Just little bits of news. We've got a last minute. Anybody who doesn't have tickets to Laguna, Gordon Howell with Pole Position is set up a suite just like last year. This time, all the proceeds are going to the Peter Lenz Fund, and. He's now has an offer for 30% off the list price. So it'll be if you go to the link that we have in the show notes and type in the code RTX30, you'll get a 30% discount on their package. And that includes, you know, entry, parking, paddock passes. You know, they have a really cool little suite set up right at the start and finish line, very close to the start and finish line. And they've, you know, wine and beer, and they feed you. And you if it's going to be hot, you're going to be out of the sun. So it's great, and it's a really good deal. And then the other thing is, we're going to have obviously a meetup. I don't have the exact time. We're going to be posting it on Facebook, and you can email us at meetup@motopodcast.com to find that out. Jim and I are going to be there. There's going to be lots of, I think Mark Miller will be there. With stickers, yes. Oh, yeah. I believe Mark Miller will be there. So it should be pretty epic. And we'll have obviously talk more about that next week. That's it for all the little bits of news. You have anything else?
Yeah, I want to ask you something.
Yeah.
Who do you think is going to be the winner at Saxon Ring this weekend?
Ooh. On the Honda, I think it's going to be Stoner. Yeah,
Think it's going to be Stoner?
Yeah, I think it's going to be Stoner. I think Lorenzo has a good shot. This is a really great round for him. He's not hurting anymore. Like Ben Spies says, it's just the acceleration. So this is a track where that might actually come into play.
There's a lot of slow corners.
So I think the Hondas are going to have an edge. And Stoner's done well here before.
I think Stoner's going to have a hedge.
That's what I'm saying.
I think it's going to be Stoner and Lorenzo.
Yep. Yeah. No matter what happens, Rossi will be sixth. You know, somehow he'll be sixth.
Yeah, because he said that he's going to try new things, more experimental crap on his Ducati. So it's going to be interesting. It's going to be more, well, let's see how it goes. Let's do a crappy qualifying and then finish sixth. let's do what we do best this season.
Yeah. Yep.
That's why the weather's going to play an important part. If it's a little bit different. What I'm also interested to see is how Cal Crutchlow does. He's been struggling really bad with...
Since the return?
Yeah, but apparently is because of something on his setup that makes him push wide.
It's the same problem. It's just much worse for Cal.
Yeah, but that wasn't at Assen. Apparently, what happened at Mugello with Colin, and I saw this as soon as they left the grid. Colin and Bautista were the only ones with soft rear. And they obviously didn't have any sessions on the afternoon in the dry, so they didn't know how the soft tire would react with warm weather. So we risked it and went with the warm tire. When I saw the track temperatures up to 40 degrees, I thought, well, he's screwed. He's definitely screwed. And, well, there you go. He got screwed with that tire. Him and Bautista started going backward.
All right, yeah. There'll be lots of interesting stuff to watch, and it's coming up. It's just a few, just 24 hours away.
It's going to be intense now. Yeah. It's going to be intense now. And then we have Laguna straight away. So yep. It's going to be a very good, interesting couple of weeks.
Definitely.
So looking forward to talk to you when it all goes down.
Right on, man. All right, keep on healing. And
if I don't talk to you before Laguna, have a good weekend, you and Jim.
Thanks.
So
I'm sure it'll be great.
Well, bye guys.
Okay, ciao dude.